And welcome to another installment of The Two Brandons. This is Brandon Thomas.
And this is Brandon Easton.
And we'd like to thank you for once again joining us for The Two Brandons podcast. This installment, we are going to talk about San Diego Comic-Con 2013 that just concluded about a week and a half ago. Hopefully everyone has suitably recovered and are back to full strength after the show. So me and Brandon thought we would just spend some time talking about our personal experiences at this year's con, what we took from it, and what we'd like to see in the future. So I think we're just going to jump in and get started. And I'm going to get started with Mr. Easton. I would like to know what your personal high point of this year's convention was.
Lord almighty, man. It was like the Alpine mountain range. I mean, there were so many high points, bro. I mean, but realistically, I would guess that the Insight to Indies and the Writer's Journey mega panel that lasted 2 hours on Thursday, that was pretty damn amazing. I mean, we had a collection of talent of all backgrounds, all, you know, economic, you know, ideologies, all kinds of diverse content. You had a bunch of people up on stage just given the real deal about how to break into the industry as an independent creator. And I feel that the Comic-Con culture within the actual convention, I believe the panels tend to be a lot more indie-oriented than the actual show is. So I really, really like the fact that we had a mega panel of 2 whole hours just talking about what you need to do as a creator and, more importantly, as a writer, how to break in. And I had a great time. It was my first time ever hosting a panel at Comic-Con in my life. I mean, I'd done WonderCon. We had done Stan Lee's Kamikaze. We'd done a bunch of other smaller shows. But Comic-Con is the granddaddy of them all. I mean, if you want to be a professional wrestler, you want to go to WWE. If you want to be in comics, you got to go to San Diego Comic-Con. You know what I mean?
Yep.
So that was just an extraordinary experience, and that was probably one of the biggest high points of the convention for me. And also just seeing everybody. I mean, seeing you, seeing a bunch of folks from the East Coast who I talk to on Facebook all the time. Just seeing folks in person is a whole different ball game, man. Shaking somebody's hand, giving them a hug, just sitting down and talking, and everybody loving the same thing. I mean, that to me was the high point, man. Just so much love amongst the creators that we'd already known and folks who I had never met in person but had talked to on Facebook for the last 4 or 5 years. It was an amazing experience, man. So, you know, I toss it back to you. What was yours, man?
Well, just feeding off of that, I was actually at that panel. It was a great, great panel. A lot of great advice for aspiring and up-and-coming creators. Great diversity on the panel. And, you know, I agree that within Comic-Con, I know that Comic-Con has gotten a bad rap the last few years for having moved away from its primary focus. And, you know, people complain that it's all about, you know, the Hollywood studios and the Hall H and the Ballroom 20s. But
right,
just like you said, there is really a, you know, Comic-Con still exists, you know, and there are a lot of panels. There are a lot of opportunities that really show you that comics are still a focus of the show. I mean, are they as big of a focus of the show as people would like them to be? That's debatable. But, you know, I always treat the cons like a, you know, it's almost like a family reunion. You know, it's like we people that you only see maybe once a year if you're lucky. Sometimes you may only see people every couple of years, but I always enjoy that experience of touching base with people that, you know, you correspond with online, that you don't always have the opportunity to, you know, to go and see. And like you said, being able to just, you know, shake somebody's hand or give somebody a hug or just, you know, laugh together in person is just, it's just an invaluable, you know, experience for me. And my high point of the con was also a panel that I was involved in on Sunday. I did a panel that was put on by racebending.com called Shattering Convention and Comic Book Storytelling.
Yeah, how did that go, man?
Oh, it went great. It was fantastic. It was pretty much like a big exclamation point on my entire weekend at the show. It was a great panel. I shared the stage with Gail Simone, who everybody knows, Christina Strain, who colored a number of books for Marvel Comics over the years, Gene Yang, who does the Avatar books for Dark Horse and previously did American Born Chinese. I forget her name. Her first name is Spike, but she does, she actually does adult, like, porno comics. She does, puts together an anthology called Smut Peddler. So it was just a great topic of conversation. And it's always, you know, validating to see that a lot of time, you know, me and you personally have spent a lot of time talking about diversity in the industry, what we need to do better, what we're doing poorly right now. And it's really cool to actually do these panels and see that there are a number of people that are just as concerned, if not more so, by the same issues that we are. So I had a great time up on the panel. I think I accidentally started a little argument that I didn't intend to. And after the panel, I had a great, 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 true conversation with Gail Simone and her wonderful husband. So I think
what was the fight?
Well, you know, a lot of the people up on the stage had created independent comics, including me. And I made a comment that while independent comics does play a massive role in the industry and can service parts of the comic reading public that the mainstream publishers aren't, for whatever reason, that the fan base should not let the mainstream companies off the hook. And as creators, that I made a comment that I was not going to settle for being pushed into the corner of the comics industry, which unfortunately is where independent comics resides, sales-wise and market share-wise. So I made that comment that basically, you know, being able to do independent comics and telling your own stories and creating your own characters is vitally important, but it's also important to keep the pressure on the mainstream companies to at least make some kind of attempts to diversify the kind of books that they're offering and to diversify the people that are actually creating the books. So it kind of started a little kind of like mainstream versus indie comics debate on the panel and the relative importance of each. So that was that was something interesting that that I really didn't intend, but it turned into kind of an interesting segue for us to discuss, because some of us have done work for the major companies and some of us haven't. And you know, right, you know how it is. There are some people that just have a very they have a very dismissive notion of the role that mainstream comics can and sometimes should play in, you know, determining the market trends or opening up, trying to open up a section of the marketplace that has been closed to them for whatever reason, usually by their own inaction. But, you know, it was unintended, but it was still pretty interesting. And it was, it just goes to show you that, you know, that we don't agree about everything, even though we agree on certain kind of ideals and philosophies. The way that everyone chooses to go about bringing about that change is slightly different. So overall, it was a great discussion, and it took place on the final day of the show. It was Sunday afternoon, and it was a nice little kind of charge of inspiration for me, kind of taking me out of the convention personally. So it was great. It was great. I did a panel for a similar panel for Race Bending last year, and hopefully it'll become a yearly thing.
Awesome, man. I mean, I wish I had gone. I was already gone. I left.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Really late Saturday night. I had to get out of there.
Yeah, I think that's probably how you escaped the con crud, right?
Oh, dude, I figured out the trick to not getting sick. And for everyone who's listening, if you go to Comic-Con and you want to stay there from like Wednesday to Saturday, The best way to not get sick is to leave on Saturday night. The roads are clear, particularly if you live in LA and you need to get back up to Los Angeles. The roads are clean and clear, and you don't get sick. I mean, I felt myself getting sick on Sunday, even in my own place. So I realized that if I had stayed, I probably would have succumbed to the nerd flu. So I'm pretty happy I got
out of there. Yeah. Usually I don't get it. Usually I escape it, but not this year.
I'm sorry, bro.
Not this year at all. So, but it's all cleared up now. So we're back to, this Death Star is fully operational. So we're all good now.
Awesome.
But, I wanted to ask you about, every year you go to the show. The career of a professional comic writer or artist always takes very unusual turns. Things that you didn't expect are always happening and demanding a response. So along those lines, what was the most unexpected thing or the most unexpected development that happened to you at Comic-Con that you can talk about? Some of the unexpected stuff, has to remain under wraps for now, but out of the stuff that you can actually tell us about, what was the thing you were surprised at by Comic-Con?
Well, I actually don't have a... Well, let me say this. There are a lot of really cool things that happened to me, a lot of really cool people I met. I had some absolutely fantastic meetings that I really, really can't get into because, I don't know what's going to happen, and some of the stuff is, sworn to secrecy and so forth and so on. The one thing I do want to discuss, and I hate to make it a negative thing because I really don't want to make it negative, but there was something I noticed this year that was evident that has been around for a while, but it wasn't as evident as it was this year. And there was definitely a vibe of racism on the floor this year. Mm. And how I define that is how people at booths and how people at groups and how people in general relate to each other. And, for many, many years, black folk did not go to the convention scene because the convention scene was openly hostile to black folks. And a lot of the ways they say, the convention scene is openly hostile to women who dress sexy in the cosplaying. Well, there was a point in time when blacks didn't go, black men or women did not go to the conventions because it was an openly hostile place with hardcore fanboy racists. Well, this last year, there was a couple of events or incidents, I should say,
yes,
that people reported about security harassing them for their IDs at the gate. And it seemed to be mainly black and Latino folks who had been asked to produce identification. But one of the things that happened to me twice, and I'm going to call these people out because I don't give a damn at this point. Out back, and there's like a Greek theater arboretum kind of thing on the backside facing the water of Comic-Con. There were these armored knights fighting. It was like a big group of people wearing, medieval armor, and they were in full contact battle. And it was like the coolest thing I'd ever seen. And apparently, they really want people to join up and, join their group. And they're called the Society for Creative Anachronism, SCA, Society for Creative Anachronism. Mm-hmm. And they're basically it's basically like a Renaissance fair kind of thing where people dress up like they were in medieval England and, they act like they're there and they wear battle armor and they do full contact fighting. I mean, they're pretty safe, but it is full contact, full speed fighting. And when you hit somebody in a crucial point, the person has to fall because they've been defeated. And like I said, when you see it play out in live action, it is one of the coolest things you could possibly imagine. Now, I probably would never do it because obviously this is not my thing. I don't dress up ever, and I probably wouldn't have the money to go through the whole point of buying armor and going through the whole process. But the thing I found very interesting is that they had people walking around handing out flyers to let people know about how they can join up, and the women who were handing them out would not give me a flyer. They walked past me like four or five times. I even stuck my hand out once, and the woman just kept walking. And I found that to be very, very insulting and infuriating. Now, like I said, I probably wouldn't do it, but they were handing out these bright blue flyers to everybody who was watching except to me. And I found that to be a very strange and disgusting thing, And that was very unexpected because I've been going to Comic-Con, for the last like 4 or 5 years straight.
Right.
And then before that, I had went in 1999 and 2003, and I'd never experienced anything like that before. And I just felt that it was a very strange, very interesting vibe. I mean, people just seem to be really, I don't know, there seemed to be like an element of just anger, you know, amongst the club. Like, there's a level in the mezzanine of just fan clubs, you know, whether it be the five, like the 501, you know, 501st, you know, Stormtrooper Legion, the guys that do all the Stormtrooper cosplay in Southern California. Uh-huh. And they had like the Legion of Superheroes and all these like just fan groups and Star Trek stuff. And none of those people were very friendly. And I don't know if they weren't being friendly to me or they were just not friendly to anyone. And I kind of feel that one of the things that really kills the convention experience is unhappy you know, retailers or unhappy exhibitors. And my thought is, if you don't want to be there, you shouldn't spend all that money and go. I kind of think that there's a long list of people who would be dying to be in your spot. And if you're mad or upset or just pissed off about whatever, maybe you shouldn't be sitting behind a booth.
Yeah.
You know, and that's really the one thing that really bothered me. Out of all the incredible, amazing things, just this weird kind of racist dismissal, if you want to call it that, like just disregard for me and other people, because I had other people talk about this kind of event, you know, this kind of situation too. So while I can't say that, you know, I had a bunch of bad stuff happen to me, because obviously it didn't, but the one thing that really did shock me this year was this like low level undercurrent of just, I don't know, just anti-black sentiment. It just felt very tangible this year, and I never felt it at Comic-Con before. So that kind of threw me for a loop.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have heard similar things. I'm not going to call out anybody's names, but we can you know, if you do some Googling, you can probably find some of the complaints that certain people had. I also heard a very direct story about security harassing a black staffer at one of the major comic book companies, you know, kind of like embarrassing him on the show floor in front of his coworkers and demanding that he produce his badge. So, you know, I think I would hope that that kind of stuff goes reported and it goes answered by Comic-Con, because obviously I don't think Comic-Con is does their own security. I think they're probably, you know, subcontracting that out, hiring a private company. But those are definitely the type of things that they need to know about, and they need to make when they get ready to make their decision for who's gonna do security for next year's show. I would hope that that's something that they strongly consider, because, I mean, the interesting thing about conventions is that if you just went to a typical comic book convention and you just looked around, you would think that the industry is a lot more diverse than it actually is.
Right.
You know, there are all sorts of people at the show wearing costumes, not wearing costumes, men, there's a huge amount of female attendees, which again is something else that I don't think you would expect, you know, if that's maybe your first show. But I did hear some strange story. There's one I'll send you after we're done recording that's a very kind of disgusting, enraging story about a young black female artist being turned away from at one of the Comic-Con parties.
Wow.
In a very kind of nasty, racist way. The most kind of blatant racism that you'll probably ever encounter. And I don't know if the proximity to the Trayvon Martin verdict had anything to do with kind of the strange kind of hostile vibe that some attendees did experience at the show. I mean, I wouldn't dismiss that as a kind of like an underlying cause, but I did hear that there were some unfortunate issues at the show that specifically affected black and Latino attendees far more than white attendees. I think there have been a few reports about security harassing white attendees, but there are far more, and far more, the confrontations are far more severe and harsh when they involved, you know, black and Latino fans. So hopefully the people that were involved reported those incidents, and hopefully Comic-Con will take notice of that when they get ready to do next year's show. The thing that I was surprised by, which is, this is a very, very self-serving, but I was very surprised by the response to this podcast. Oh, yeah.
That is true, my friend.
I don't know why. I'm always surprised. I don't know why, but there were so many more people that came up to me this year and said that they were listening to the podcast and they enjoyed the podcast and that we should keep doing what we're doing than I was expecting at all. You know, I think that's just personally, I always kind of underestimate you know, my own reach, I guess, in a way. And it was really cool to be, you know, I got approached by several particularly black male fans, black male comics fans over the weekend, you know, saying nice things about this show. So, you know, that's always great. It's good to know, you know, people are out there listening and that and they're appreciating it. So that was kind of my my unexpected moment from the convention. I did not expect people to say so many kind things about the two Brandons podcast, and they did. So that's great, and you know, we're gonna keep on doing it for as long as we can, and we thank you guys for listening and enjoying it. So
absolutely,
you know.
Yeah, a lot of people did come up and say great things about the podcast. That is very true, man. I mean, people were like, dude, man, what's up, bro? This was awesome. I'm like, wow, y'all really listening. So
Right. It's like, man, people are really listening to this stuff. Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, kind of like along those lines, you know, also wanted to talk a little bit about what, you know, every year when I do this show, I ultimately take something a little different from it. And to me, conventions are always great for, you know, kind of recharging the batteries, kind of, you know, a big kind of dose of inspiration, because, you know, you go to these conventions and you can feel it. It's like this thing that you want is so close, you know, like you spend an entire weekend walking through it. And it's like, wow, you know, this is how it is to be like a professional comic book writer. You know, like I've done better than I think. You know, I have made, you know, some really decent progress. And that's the primary thing I take away from the show, primarily just a big dose of inspiration and kind of like a mark to aim for in the coming year, you know, kind of like, and anytime I go to the show, I'm like, oh, okay, well, it's cool. I did X number of signings and I did X number of panels, but next year, you know, I want to do more, you know, I want to have new books out. I want to have more Miranda Mercury. I want to have some new creator owned projects out. So, to me, that's, I always feel really, 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 really good about comics and the prospect of making comics in the wake of the convention. And it's also great, you know, seeing other professionals like you and other people, kind of like your contemporaries,
right,
that are either at the same, like, kind of like at the same level you're at, or they're a little ahead, or they're a little behind. So it's really, to me, it's very energizing emotionally to kind of be a part of that for a few days, to see just like, you know, the passion and the perseverance and the persistence in some of my fellow writers and creators. And it always feels very possible at Comic-Con. Like when I'm at Comic-Con, I feel Like everything I want for, you know, kind of like my career or my creations is very possible, and it's right at my fingertips, you know, and that's always great to kind of propel me through the end of the year, you know, work-wise.
Oh, nice.
So, you?
Well, following that up... Well, I mean, one of the things that always happens with me and Comic-Con is I always leave with a feeling of, like, it's Christmas morning. Uh-huh. You never know what's going to happen as a result of Comic-Con.
Right.
And it was a lot different when I just went there as a fan than as a professional. Leaving as a fan, you just feel that, okay, I've gotten all these things, I've met all these really cool people, and... You know, I bought all this really cool stuff, you know, and then leaving as a professional, you're like, okay, people are taking me seriously now. And each year you realize that you're not as amateur as you imagine yourself to be.
Yes, you know? Definitely.
Like, you start to see the fact that people are taking what you say very seriously. They're taking what you do very seriously. And particularly if you're African American and you're on the forefront of talking about and trying to correct the historical, you know, inadequacies of race relations in the industry, you definitely start to realize how important everything you do will be from here on in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm not trying to, you know, put myself up as a Spike Lee figure or a Harry Belafonte or a, you know, Medgar Evers of comics or anything like that, because I've been accused of that by an idiot at one point in time. Now, this idiot on Facebook said, "Were you trying to be the Spike Lee of comics?" I'm like, "No, you idiot. I'm just talking about these issues, you dumb fuck." Anyway, I blocked that dude. It's stupid, idiot. Anyway, I'm not trying to be anything like that. And neither, I mean, I can't speak for, you know, Brandon Thomas here, but I mean, I'm guessing that he's not either. But what we're doing is just sometimes by physically existing, we are creating a kind of change, a paradigm shift in the industry. And one of the things that happened with me at this year was that I took a lot of pictures, and the majority of the pictures were of me and other black creators. Mm-hmm. And that has never happened to me before at Comic-Con.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's starting to show that not only are we showing up, but there are people who have and are creating amazing things, who are starting to get more traction.
Yep.
You know, so I think that what I've taken away from this is that we've got to just keep on creating things, yep. No matter how hard it is, no matter how much it hurts, and it's going to hurt, you know, no matter how
many people it hurts.
Right. You know, and no matter how many people will tell you that you're not making a difference or they're not going to buy our stuff. And no matter how many black geeks ignore you, you know, we still have got to keep on creating and working very hard at all this so that in the future, you know, other creators will be inspired, and there'll be material for them to look at as an exemplar from which to build their career from, you know? Yeah. So I feel that, I guess, to summarize, I just had a feeling that we are making a difference finally, and it might be only 2-3% of a difference, but that's a huge shift in from what I've seen in the past. And I'm hoping, and I think this is really where the issue comes in, and this is something I've dealt with for a while, and I'm going to put it out there. I'm hoping that there can be a bridge between black comic book illustrators and black comic book writers. There's a kind of weird gulf between those two communities that persists, and I don't know where it came from. I don't know why it's there, but it's still there, and I don't know what to do about that, because it seems like there's black writers and then there's black illustrators. And there's no real, like, sense of community between the two. I mean, we might know an artist here and there, but, you know, trying to build with black, specifically black male comic book illustrators is very tough. Mm-hmm. You know, because they have their own issues and they have their own ideas about what a writer is and what a writer should be. And I think that's the one thing we've really got to correct, that we've got to find a way to mend whatever, you know, divide that does exist. And this is something that people have talked about a lot. And I saw it again at Comic-Con, because Artist Alley is a very interesting place at Comic-Con. And
yes,
one of the things I saw was that, at least what, you know, I've seen this and I've observed this, is that if a black male writer goes up to a black male comic book illustrator and tries to connect with them, a lot of time there's a healthy dose of skepticism on the side of the black illustrator. Mm. Like, they make the assumption that you're not serious or that you're trying to get something from them. Mm. mm-hmm. or you're trying to take advantage of them or their position. And I think we've got to stop that mentality, because I've seen it play out for the last decade, really. And I saw that again at Comic-Con. Like I said, it was a lot of positives, but the negatives really stuck out. So I think that in the future, what we've got to do is work on more community building and realize that there are going to be black creators who have no desire to connect with us, who have no desire to build or even be associated with anything black. And once you realize that, I think we'll be a lot healthier. But I feel that a lot of us are still trying to build with people who don't want to build with us. And we've got to stop that. We've got to realize that there are creators out there of color who have no desire to be put in the same quote-unquote category with us. So that's something I think that, you know, we're going to have to – well, I've already addressed it. I've addressed it for 10 years now. It hasn't made that much of a difference. So I'm thinking to myself that – all the new folks that get in don't practice and don't follow the pattern of what a lot of black male illustrators and comics have done in terms of how they relate to black writers.
I think that there's also something to be said for not every black creator, whether he's a writer or an artist, is going to want to do a book like Miranda Mercury or a book like Jamal Eagles, Molly Danger. You know, some guys, some writers and some artists are just, they're just working, you know, they're just working, they're making a living, and they don't have these, you know, everyone doesn't have the same grand aspirations to kind of change the world. If, you know, and that sounds much more kind of, you know, lofty than our aspirations probably are, but you know, for some people, it's just not that important to them. For for a lot of creative people, the importance to them is to just stay working, you know, stay working, stay relevant, keep cashing checks, keep getting put on projects. You know, not everybody really internalizes the fact that there are, you know, no black writers at Marvel or DC right now. You know, to a lot of fans, white and black, that really doesn't mean anything. And I think the trick is that I think personally that collaboration is going to be the future. You know, I keep saying it over and over and over again that a lot of us need to get together. We need to form collectives. We need to create something on our own and just let the products of that work just stand for itself. But some people just, they just aren't interested in that. So I think the trick is actually figuring out what kinds of people you want to ally yourselves with. I mean, if personally at this point, just cause I'm probably, you know, a little kind of jaded about the whole thing. I mean, if you approach anyone, an artist, white or black, that doesn't want to collaborate with you, that doesn't want to sacrifice with you, that doesn't want to build something with you, then move on and find somebody else, because there are plenty of people out there that are interested, that legitimately want to collaborate, that legitimately want to advance themselves, that legitimately want to advance comics and the type of comics that we see. And, you know, I think that's just kind of what I want to see going forward, what I'd like to see from next year's San Diego. I just want to see an emphasis on the relationships that are working, on the relationships that are valuable, that are giving people inspiration, and that's what it is. I mean, it's about inspiration. I had a few years ago, I think this was at C2E2, probably in maybe the first year they did C2E2, so maybe 2009, 2010, and I met this young brother at the Archaea booth. I'll put his name out there. He'll be okay. His name is Alvern Ball.
Yeah, I know him. Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just at the Archaea booth, you know, just talking to people because we were working on Miranda at the time. Book wasn't quite out yet, but it was about to come out. And he approached me and he introduced himself and he told me this story. So flashback, several years before that, probably 5 or 6 years before that, maybe, I was living in the suburbs and I was going to a comic shop that was run by a guy that had a really close relationship with a professor at Columbia College in Chicago. And this professor was teaching a class on comic books and graphic novels. This was right when, you know, universities were getting on the comics bandwagon and trying to teach, you know, comics and the aesthetics of graphic novel creation as a, you know, an actual class. And his professor friend asked him to come in and speak to his class because this guy also spent time as an editor at one of the indie publishers. And so since I was one of his customers, he invited me to come along with him to kind of, you know, serve as like the writer side of the equation. So it was an editor and a writer. And we went to this class at Columbia and talked about our experiences in the industry, about creating comics. And little did I know, Alvern was in that class as an undergrad. Wow. And I don't know what it was I said. I can't imagine what it was I said, but something that happened in that class inspired Alvern and gave him the fuel, gave him, helped to give him a push to show him that he could create comics, you know, as a, you know, as a young black man. So, I mean, that's kind of what we have to kind of keep an eye on, and something that I always have to be reminded on, that people are watching us, and whether we like it or not, you know, we can provide an example to someone, and we have no idea, you know, the influence or the fuel that we might be providing someone else that we haven't even met, to stand as an example that, you know, hey, you know, that guy's doing comics, you know, why not me? And I think that that's the most important thing, you know, to always keep in mind, you know, on top of all of the kind of negative experiences that people have with other professionals or with fans or with companies. You know, you just have to keep in mind you don't know who is watching, and you don't know who needs you to say the exact thing that they need to hear, you know, to keep going, just like we did when we were, you know, coming up in the game. Everyone has their own story about, you know, the experiences that gave them inspiration and that helped push them forward. And, you know, to me, that's the important thing in the end. Like, that takes precedence over all of the negativity and all of the kind of the self-doubt and then the doubts from the outside. To me, that is what is important. You know, you never know who's watching you, and you never know who needs you to keep going so they can keep going. So that's kind of, you know, my... I guess my summation of that whole issue. I mean, if you meet people that don't want to work with you, keep looking, you know.
Absolutely, right.
Don't take that as an indictment on your own talent level or your own seriousness in what you do and what you want to do. Just keep going, you know. That and that's something that I just try to tell people over and over and over again. This is going to take forever, and if you don't have a thick skin, if you can't actually do the work and finish the work, you are going to fail. I mean, if you can't devote at least 10 years of your life, if you're lucky, I would say maybe 7 years if you're super lucky, but most people that are successful in this business have put in a decade of work. And that's a decade of frustration. That's a decade of doing things that you aren't being immediately paid or compensated for.
Trial and error, man.
Trial and error. That's all it is. You know, mistakes. That's setbacks. I mean, that's, you know, that's life. I mean, that's just how, that's what happens because of how long it takes to get done. And if you can't put in that type of time and you can't commit that long, you're never going to get there. You're never going to see the end point. And, you know, it's been done, so why can't you do it? I mean, I'm doing it. Easton's doing it. I mean, we met a ton of people at Comic-Con, and corresponded with, that are doing it. So, you know, I think that that's something that I always try to keep in mind whenever I get frustrated or angry. There's a lot of anger. I won't deny that. But there's a lot of anger about some of the, like you said, kind of the inequalities of kind of like the modern comics industry. But you never know who needs you to keep going so they can keep going. So you can't quit. You know, absolutely. People are watching you, like it or not, believe it or not. You know, it took me a long time to believe this, but it's like, I people are looking at me. I'm like a role model to somebody. I don't know, man. It's a lot of responsibility.
Well, there you go.
So, yeah, man. So, I think I had a great show. I mean, it was great seeing you. It was great seeing a lot of other people. And I always have big dreams and kind of like a big benchmark or threshold that I want to hit by next year's show. You know, like next year, you know, I want to do 3 panels. I want to have 2 new books out. So, you know, it's right. Always
kind of... Well, next year, I would like to be closer to the convention itself. I mean, lately... Last couple of years, it's impossible to get, you know, a hotel downtown. Oh, and generally speaking, I would say that I'm trying my damnedest for like 2014 to be in downtown San Diego, because really the most ideal situation for a professional at Comic-Con, particularly if you want to do the after party and the bar scene where a lot of really big deals are made and a lot of really real networking occurs, is that you need to be able to go back to your room, drop your stuff off, refresh yourself, and then go back onto the street rather than, you know, leave the con, get on a shuttle bus, be on the bus for an hour, get back to your room, change or whatever, then get back on the bus for another hour to come back downtown. Right. That really makes it difficult to maintain a sense of momentum, you know, particularly, you know, like creative momentum and spiritual momentum, because you really do get burnt out real fast, because you could walk from one side to the other and be done. Yeah. You know, just like, you know, the place is like, what, 2 football fields long.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not a joke.
I carried a pedometer with me a couple days I was there. And I mean, the numbers that I got back were just unbelievable.
Yeah. And I think, you know, for next year, I mean, I'm really hoping the industry continues on the path of diversity for women, for people of color, and also just different viewpoints. It's not even just about race, because I'm liking the fact that there's all these new crime books on the market. I like the fact that there's more supernatural books on the market. I would like to see more people who aren't already established get some big hits. You know what I mean? Like, there's like 14,000 Robert Kirkmans out there. You know, who are all of all backgrounds and races, and even, you know, women. You know, there's some creators out there who just deserve just a little bit of sunshine. You know what I mean? And then they'll blow up. But, you know, once again, we got to get the marketplace to shift to acknowledge the existence of the independents. So I'm hoping that, as was, you know, the panel scene, because the panel scene was super independent this year. I'm hoping that vibe makes its way to the floor. Because the one thing that you'll notice about Comic-Con, and I'm glad that they put the video games on the far side of the convention because it forced people to walk all the way to the other side, is that you notice that the movie and TV side of the convention hall is packed, but the retailer side, the small press area, is completely empty.
Yeah.
And
especially in my mind, the small press side.
Right. In my mind, I would say anytime I want to take a break, I don't go outside. I just go to small press. You know, because nobody's over there. There's nobody standing around. And in previous years, they had the video games like Xbox and Activision and Sony and all those other people. They had them tucked into the same corner as Fox and Warner Brothers. So you really had no incentive, if you weren't into comic books, to walk on the retail side. But what they did this year was move the video game section to the opposite side of the hall so that people would have to walk through the retailer area and small press. Right. So I really like the fact that they made that change, because if they didn't, you know, I feel bad for a lot of those retailers who spend tens of thousands of dollars to get to Comic-Con and only make about, you know, $500 or $600 over the weekend. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that must hurt.
Yes, you know? And I'm sure it does.
If they continue to, because I mean, the first time I ever went to Comic-Con, it felt, this was 1999.
Okay.
It felt like the small press and big guys were all mixed up. So you didn't have Dark Horse and Marvel and DC and at the time Image, and it was before IDW. And I think I'm trying to remember who was big back then, like Kitchen Sink Press and what's the guy, Brian Polito? What was that company that did Lady Death?
Oh, Chaos?
Yeah. Like they were, you know what I mean? Like everybody in 1999 was like kind of spread all over the place. And I worked for Dreamwave in 2003. So Dreamwave had a big old booth there too. And they were like, in a different spot. So it was a thing where you had to find people in a sense that you had to go all over the floor to see all the stuff. Right. But throughout the 2000s, when I didn't go, you know, I didn't go from 2003 until 2010. So but when I went back in 2010, I noticed that the floor had been cut in half.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like one side was just Hollywood and the other side was comic books. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And I feel that in 2014, I would really like to see them maybe mix it up a little bit more where you have Marvel further away from DC and Dark Horse further away from Arcana or Arkea or Boom and Image a little bit further away from everybody so that you have to physically go to a different part of the floor. Right. I like the old design of having everything mixed up. I don't like everything clumped together because I do feel like the retailers get shafted big time.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I also noticed this year, I don't know if it was just my imagination, but it seemed a lot less busy and overly congested on the show floor.
Well, it depends. No, I'm going to tell you something. You know, one of the things that I did do is I wrote a letter to the people, you know, the convention organizers, because I do believe people are taking advantage of the professional status.
Oh.
Because I'm going to tell you, there are people there who are not professionals, who have a 4-day professional badge.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sitting there like, dude, you're taking up space from a legit professional who deserves to be on this floor. And I went to the, did you know about the professionals lounge in room 30?
I've known about it, but I've never actually gone.
Oh, well, they move it around every year to make to confuse the hell out of you. Because last year it was basically, to make a long story short, when I was in the professionals lounge, I'd say, professionals, it's not that many of us working at any given time. So it's not like, because a lot of people seem to think the comic book industry or Hollywood itself is this massive thing, but it's really not.
No.
When you look at all the people who are currently working, you can pretty much figure it out. You know what I mean? You recognize the same faces. And I saw a lot of people who are not working on anything, but for some reason they still qualify as a professional. Now, when you look at New York Comic Con, for example, they have a very stringent, tough process in order to get a professional badge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like everything else. Like at Comic-Con, you sign up as a pro and somehow you manage to stay in the system for a long time. At New York Comic-Con, you have to reapply every year.
Yeah.
And they want to make sure that you are actually a professional. So, because they say it's a fan-based convention and the fans should have this tickets. Whereas Comic-Con still, you know, is operating in an old way that everybody's on the honor system. And I'm thinking the honor system really got to go because there are people who are flat out lying. And I'm going to tell you something. I was at preview night last year, right?
Uh-huh.
When me and the Lion Forge guys, we went to preview night.
Okay.
And it wasn't that bad.
Mm.
I mean, there were people, clearly, but it wasn't like, it didn't feel like Saturday.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Wednesday preview night is just another day now.
Yeah, like, but it wasn't that big. But even in 1 year's time, man. And for those who don't know, preview night is Wednesday night at Comic-Con. They open the floor to people who did purchase a preview night badge. But generally speaking, it usually was the night professionals get to walk around and kind of look at stuff before everybody else gets there, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. That's what it used to be.
Well, bro, this year, man, I went in a preview night. I got there a little bit late. But it felt like Saturday. It was crowded. It was already stinking. It was hot. And I'm like, yo, what is going on here? I mean, it was a mess. And I'm thinking to myself, you know what? The reason is that a lot of these people are faking the funk. I mean, some people actually stink. But then there are people who are faking the funk in the sense that they think that are pretending to be professionals.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking that Comic-Con, instead of using that weird login system they've got, I think they should adopt the same system that New York Comic-Con does, which is you need to prove every year that you're working on something current, or you have something on the market that's current, or you had a book that's still being sold. Not, you know, I did a cover 8 years ago for, you know, some, you know, non-existent company. Right, and I'm still a professional. You're not a professional if you did a cover once. You might have been once, but if you're not doing anything now, you're taking a spot away from someone who deserves to be there. And that's my opinion. Mm. There are people who argue it. I mean, I already got into some nasty arguments with people about that subject. Oh, yeah. Because somebody said to me, well, how do you know who's a professional and who's not? And I'm like, well, because I look at your name, and I'm not saying I know everybody, but if I see a name once, I recognize that name forever more. And there are people who I know for a fact do not do anything. I was in the professional lounge, right? And I ran into a bunch of people I knew. But then it was a whole section of folks who you could tell were just kind of like there. Like they weren't there because they'd done anything. Maybe they did something, or they got lucky, or they lied on their application. But somehow they got in, and now they keep coming back. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, you're taking up space. And the reason why New York Comic Con did that was because professionals were selling badges in New York Comic Con on the street. And they wanted to put on – no, they were. Bro, trust me on this. They were doing it. They do it at Comic-Con, but they, you know, people don't really pay attention.
Right.
So I'm thinking if they made it a little bit more stringent and then let more fans in, you know, you'd see a lot less of the foolishness on the floor, and you'd see a little bit more I think you'd be able to do a lot more business because you're actually getting people who want to be there who are going to spend money.
Right.
You know, instead of professionals who are going there just to hang out and not, you know, contribute to the pot, so to speak.
Yeah, because San Diego does, I think their professional verification, for everybody that doesn't know, I believe it's for 3 years. So once you're verified as a professional, they only check your verification status every 3 years. So,
and there's ways around that, too, man. There's ways around... No, it is. No, trust me. No, I know people who... I'm not going to call them out, but for example, there is somebody I know who did a cover once in 2003, because I met him in 2003 on the floor, and that dude has been able to get into Comic-Con based on that one cover from all those years ago. Even in 2013, it's been 10 years, he still gets in based on that one cover.
That's crazy.
Yeah, there's a way around everything, but I guarantee what? There ain't no way around that New York Comic-Con professional badge.
Every year they're like, what are you working on? What book's coming out? Okay, I guess.
Right, exactly. And I like that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it's like, well, I mean, I can pass the test, so.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is, I'll put it like this. If I wasn't able to get in, I'd be mad, but I would be forced to understand the nature of the game. You know what I mean? Like, I'd be mad, obviously, but I would be like, you know what? I really don't belong here. Like, there's been things I've been, you know, I've been not allowed to do, you know, and I understand that, and I'm okay with that. You know, I'm like, all right, you know what? That's fine. I'm not allowed to do that, and that's quite all right. You know, that's quite all right. You know? I'd be mad at first, but then I'd get mad, you know? So, anyway.
So we'll see. We'll see what the future holds for Comic-Con. But personally, I found it like a little less congested than in previous years. And again, I almost forgot to say this. You know, I'm local now. So this was the first year that I got to go to Comic-Con locally. And it was amazing. I encourage you to move out here. It's obviously the weather is fantastic. But being able to just drive in and out of what I did was, I live in the suburbs of San Diego. So I would drive in every morning. It took about 20 minutes. I would park the car at, the mall at Horton Plaza. And then I would just walk a few blocks in. And that kind of kept us far enough away from the convention center so we could actually leave when we wanted to.
Nice.
But,
Where were you parked at again?
There's a mall in the downtown called Horton Plaza.
Okay.
It's one of the Westfield malls. So they basically sell, you know, you can pre-buy Comic-Con parking passes.
Well, I'll be damned.
Yep. Yep. So we basically, and they took like the first, I think it was like two or three levels of the parking structure, and they marked them all with Comic-Con signs. So only people that had paid for parking could park in those spots. And we didn't even have to go to the top of the structure. It was pretty cool. So, I mean, it was definitely a different experience, not having to stay at hotels and not having to pay for airfare, because I'm usually coming in from Chicago. And it was a much more relaxing experience for me. Usually when I'm coming in from out of town, there is so much money invested in this trip that you just feel like, you know, something has to happen. I paid all this money. But, you know, I basically paid for parking passes, and so I'm like, you know, I would like for something to happen, but if it doesn't, you know, I spent a few hundred dollars and whatever. So I encourage you to get local as soon as possible. It's a very, very different experience. I had a house guest. One of my boys flew in from out of town and stayed in my guest room. So it was a really cool trip, or not a cool trip, but a cool kind of experience for me this year. And you know, I feel like I'm gonna take what I need to from it. And as always, you hope that the show just gets better every year. You know, more opportunities, more diversity. And the people that are making the books and the characters that we're seeing in the books. And, you know, I would say, you know, the general impression that I got from the show personally was that it's working. What we're doing and what we're saying and what we're talking about is being recognized, and it's already been internalized by a portion of the fan base. So, you know, keep it moving. That's basically what I took from the whole experience. Good, bad, and ugly. So that for me, that was Comic-Con 2013. And a little con crud or nerd flu or nerd sickness. I forget what we're calling it, but a little of that doesn't beat, you know, kind of like the way I feel about the rest of the year now because of the convention.
Right, exactly.
Well, we're going to talk about, what's that thing called? Pacific Rim.
Oh, all right. Look, yeah, let's get that in. We got time.
We got plenty of time. It's only been an hour. I told you.
Right, it's only been an hour. See, the original plan, ladies and gentlemen, was that we were going to spend half of the show talking about Comic-Con and the other half of the show talking about Pacific Rim. But obviously, the Comic-Con element has taken about an hour. But we're still gonna devote a little time to talking about Pacific Rim. And I'm gonna let Easton start, because Easton had a very great observation from the movie that I actually hadn't fully considered the implications of. So before you get too far into it, I want you to actually talk a little more about that. The shot.
The sunlight. Okay. Well, I had, you know, and I really didn't want to talk so much about race this time, but, you know, I have to bring this up because it was something I saw that I'd never seen in a movie in my entire life. And it's a scene in the middle of the movie. Here's a spoiler. So if you haven't seen Pacific Rim, you might want to turn off right now. Now.
And why not? It's been weeks.
Now, with that being said, there's a shot in the middle when you have the Asian girl who's being rescued from one of the kaiju in the middle of, I think, was she in Tokyo?
I believe so.
It was Tokyo.
I believe so.
And, you know, one of the Jaegers, which is the giant mechs, comes along at the last second and saves this little Asian girl. And there was a shot when Idris Elba's character, you know, the pilot, he steps out of the cockpit of the mech. And the sun is behind him, framing him in a way that I've never, ever, ever seen a black male framed in a mainstream Hollywood movie. The sun was beaming down on him, and it's what we call in the industry the God shot, and it's the shot where the sun frames the hero in a silhouette. And I can't think of a movie in my entire life And I've seen a lot of science fiction movies, even with black people, where a black male was given the God shot. And it really affected me because I'm one of those people, even though I talk a lot about race and, you know, bring it up and we analyze it, I really try not to just let my life be dominated by a race, you know, a race-based observant or a race-based analysis and race-based observations. But I couldn't take my eyes off the fact, and I couldn't deny the fact that it was immense. I got an immense feeling of pride from that shot, because this is a shot where we've seen white men, and even Asian men, particularly in Asian cinema, you know, we've seen white males in America in that moment a million times, where he's the hero, the sun frames him, he comes along and reaches out his hand and saves somebody, and the little kid looks up to him with love in their eyes. But you have never, ever seen that with a black male until in Pacific Rim. I was just astonished by that shot, and I loved the movie anyway, but in that moment, it took me to a completely different place as a viewer and as a human being. I just thought, for the first time, black male heroism was validated. Like, this guy was the character, and Idris Elba's performance, he's a human being. And I thank Guillermo del Toro, and I thank the screenwriter Travis Beecham, if I'm saying his name correctly, for even putting that on film, you know, because we don't get that very often. Because even Wesley Snipes, who I absolutely adore, I love Wesley Snipes' work. I mean, even before Blade, I loved his work. I would go see movies just because Wesley Snipes was in them. But not even he had a moment like that in the Blade trilogy, you know? And it's something that really sticks to me to realize that how much have we not been, you know, validated? We've never been valorized. That's the word I'm looking for. Mm-hmm. Black men are not valorized outside of sports. You know, we're not heroes.
Damn.
You know, Jesse Jackson went and got some hostages free a few years back. And had that been anyone else, he would have been given a hero's welcome. But it was Jesse Jackson and nobody cared, you know. And Idris Elba, I mean, I don't know the brother. I heard very good things about him on a personal level. I'd love to meet the man someday. I mean, he did a great job on The Wire and a bunch of other stuff.
Luther,
man, yeah, on BBC. Yeah, BBC.
Coming
right now.
Back
yeah.
soon.
Yeah, was it season 3 or season 4 now?
Season 3.
Season 3, right. So I just felt that beyond all the incredible mecha stuff and all the inside jokes for people who are mecha heads like me, I mean, I love giant robot stuff. I'm more of a giant robot fan than anything else, really. You can thank Transformers in 1984.
I was going to say, that's Transformers.
Well, it's Generation 1. I'm a Generation 1 fan. I don't really like too many of the recent incarnations. I mean, Beast Wars gets a pass only because they connected it to Generation 1 eventually. Mm. But a lot of Transformers Prime is pretty solid, but it's not for me. You know what I mean? It's for younger kids and so forth and so on. And I have no issue with, you know, letting another generation have something that meant something to me. You know what I mean? Like, right. I'm not a producer of Transformers Prime. I know the producer, believe it or not, but his name is Jeff Klein, really cool guy. But, you know, that's not me. I didn't get a chance to write on it, and I didn't get a chance to create it. But I love giant robot stuff. And the giant robot genre is one of the few where you can really have black heroes and people from other countries and it not be something that's forced or faked. Right. And one of the things that really worked for Pacific Rim was the fact that you had a global cast.
Yes.
You had people from every corner of the world, including Africa, fighting the kaiju threat. And they were mechs that you didn't see on screen that were from Africa. If you look in the art books and all that stuff, there was other people who were also joining the fight. It's not like at the end of Independence Day when they do a montage of the world and the Africans are standing there with spears and there's a ship burning in the background. And I'm like, how the hell did they bring that ship down? No, I mean, even when I saw Independence Day, no, I'm serious. When I saw Independence Day, and they did that shot at the end, they showed Australia with the Sydney Opera House,
uh-huh.
and the Australian military, and they showed Britain, and they showed all these other places, and they did this one shot of Africa, and there's all these dudes in like dashikis and spears, they're like jumping around in the dirt, and I'm like, how did they bring that ship down? Did they throw spears into the
yes.
sky? Like, I really, like, to this day, I'm like, why would they include, anyway, so the point being is that for me, in that particular moment, it really stuck out to me. It really made a difference. It really, it was just amazing. That's all I have to say. And I had a great, great appreciation for what they did. And I'm really saddened that the American audience didn't take to Pacific Rim. And I think that what people have to understand is how easily they're manipulated by studio press.
Oh, my because God.
there's something called tracking. And for those who are not cinematically, you know, cinematically literate, particularly literate on the business side of Hollywood, of the Hollywood industry, I should say, because Hollywood is just a little piece of junk town. Right. The industry is spread all over L.A. County. When you look at tracking means that the studios go out and spend a Googleplex of money, right, trying to figure out what people are feeling about the movie and whether or not they should do any changes or should they alter their marketing strategy in order to get the most amount of people there for that opening weekend. Now, tracking takes the form of polls, formal and informal. It takes the place of, tracking is is based on preview audience reactions. Mm. And tracking also has a lot to do with studio politics. So there was some stuff going on between Warner Brothers and Legendary Pictures. And Legendary is the production company that produced pretty much everything you loved, like 300 and the Dark Knight right. trilogy. And
anything that Warner Brothers put out that you actually enjoyed was produced by Legendary.
Exactly. Now, Legendary Pictures recently just broke away from Warner Brothers because of some internal thing, and I think they wanted more control over what they were doing. So as Pacific Rim was the last, it's not the last, but it's one of the last big projects, you know, from their collaboration, there was a feeling. And you can find articles on this in Hollywood Reporter and as well as Variety and the Wall Street Journal online that talked about how there was perhaps some sabotage on the part of Warner Brothers executives who wanted to make sure that people didn't like Pacific Rim so that the Legendary collaboration wouldn't go well. And this kind of stuff really does happen, folks. And there's a lot of movies about, you know, industry politics, but really, if you ever want to see a real good movie about industry politics, there's one with, oh my God, I can't believe I blanked on the name. It's with Tim Robbins, and he kills an executive. And it came out many years ago, and I can't remember the title, and I feel stupid. I think it's called The Player, and okay. It's with Tim Robbins, and it's a movie about how the industry works, you know, and it's absolutely astonishing. And if you want to know more about the industry, folks, and particularly writers out there, there's a documentary on Netflix called Tales from the Script. It's on Netflix right now. It's called Tales from the Script. If you want to understand how this industry works, watch that documentary immediately after listening to this podcast, and you will learn. I have to go do it now. No, you really need to as a writer, because anybody who writes anything for entertainment, you need to watch Tales from the Script. It will change your entire perspective on how to approach this business. But anyway, getting back to my point. So there was a feeling that Pacific Rim was going to be sabotaged, and it worked, because in the weeks before Pacific Rim was released, you saw all these articles and all these mainstream publications saying this movie is going to tank. This movie is going to tank. No one's interested in this movie. And you had all these unverified reports of people calling it an overblown Power Rangers movie, and it looks dumb, and why is it Monsters versus Robots? This looks stupid. And I'm like, but people who saw it were like, this is awesome.
Right.
So there was a massive gulf. Yeah, a disconnect between what people who actually watched the movie were saying and what industry experts were saying. And yet the industry experts won because people didn't go out and support Pacific Rim. And I said this, and you might remember me saying this when I was at the panel at Comic-Con. People are always bitching and complaining and whining that they want something original, right? Right. They want original. I'm tired of all these comic book movies. I'm tired of all these movies based on TV shows. Okay, they give you something absolutely new, and nobody goes to see it.
Right.
And it's happened before. You know, Cloud Atlas, even though it was based on a novel, was, generally speaking, an original-looking science fiction film. Mm-hmm. You know, Oblivion with Tom Cruise, I talked about that, yep. Was generally an original concept. After Earth. Original concept, right? We've got Elysium coming out next week. Original concept.
We'll see how that does.
Right. You see what I mean? So I kind of feel that people need to stop being so easily manipulated by press and just give things a chance. That's one of the things me and you have said over and over again. People need to give stuff a chance. Folks are so willing to write something off in this weird, cynical age. It feels like people complain, but they keep taking the drinking the dirty water. It reminds me of the scene in Malcolm X when he meets Elijah Muhammad, and he has a glass of dirty water and a glass of clean water. And he says, look, if you give people only this, they'll drink it. But if you give them the choice, they'll drink the clean water. Right. But we've moved to such a point where people are so used to the dirty water, they won't even give the clean water a chance. They'll assume there's something wrong with it because it's clear. You know,
why isn't this dirty like the other one?
Right, there's something wrong.
You did something to it.
Yeah, I like this filthy taste. You know? So
that's basically what it is. I mean, it's people have gotten that's great. No. I'm glad you said that. People have gotten used to the taste of dirty water, and now when you give them clean water, they don't know what to do with it. So the only kind of response they have is to make that clean water like the dirty water. And that's exactly what happened with Pacific Rim. And I don't know if a lot of people probably do remember this, but something very similar happened last year with the John Carter movie, which personally...
Oh, yes, yes.
Which personally, I didn't enjoy that much. However, the amount of kind of venom and hatred and vitriol that these movies are attracting before anyone has actually seen them... It's just it defies description. It's hard to even describe and explain to people. But the same thing happened with Pacific Rim. I don't know if Warner Brothers was trying to drive the price down for Legendary Pictures so they can re-sign them to a much less lucrative deal than the one they had currently. But I mean, the fact that they even let Legendary hit the street to me is just. I just cannot fathom how they could even allow something like that to happen. I mean, it's seriously like, so Warner Brothers is going to make its own blockbusters now? Well, good luck with that, boys. Good luck with that.
Well, and beyond that, I have to say that, you know, as a movie, Pacific Rim was just a lot of fun. I mean, it felt like I had been transported back to like 1989. And that was that summer that had, I think, Back to the Future 2, Batman, the one with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. What was the one with the shrinking, Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Honey, I Shrunk the Kids.
I mean, I always talk about that period as being a really pure, fun, intelligent period for genre movies. And I felt like that when I was watching Pacific Rim. I really felt that I was back in 1989, and it didn't feel stupid. I mean, it was very light. I mean, obviously, it's not going to be, you know, Citizen Kane, but I wasn't expecting that. I expected a really fun, high-octane adventure movie, and I got that.
And that's exactly what it was.
And not only that, but, I mean, Del Toro and Travis Beecham, you know, they managed to sneak in all kinds of Easter eggs for those who were mecha heads. I mean, I saw stuff from this really obscure anime title called Armored Troopers Votums. Okay. And Votums, if you ever look at their masks that the mechs have, the Russian mech pilots were wearing that mask inside of their Jaeger.
Okay.
And that is one of the best Easter eggs I'd ever seen in my entire life. I was like,
I didn't notice that at all.
Oh yeah, but see, the thing is, I don't know how much of a mech head you are.
Not that much. I mean, I caught like a lot of the Evangelion stuff.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I mean,
See, we're going to have to do a whole episode about that now.
We can do a whole episode about Evangelion, G. I'd be happy to.
So, yeah, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought that visually it was amazing. I thought the action sequences were well staged. I thought everything had a very nice weight to it, and you didn't get this kind of Man of Steel. You didn't get this kind of like... Gumby look to the characters, you know, whenever the fights got really high octane. So I enjoyed it a lot. I mean, I'm ready for the Blu-ray like today.
Oh yeah.
I'm ready for the commentary and the behind the scenes and the deleted scenes and the director's cut and all of that stuff. We'll probably get. I am more than ready for. And to be honest. That is probably the movie that I have enjoyed the most this summer, top to bottom. And that'll be fun, too, when we get to the end of the summer. We can actually go back through our list and kind of rearrange how how we feel now that we've actually seen the movies. But Pacific Rim, I enjoyed quite a bit. I mean, like you said, I like the fact that it was an international cast. Everyone got to see themselves in the role of a hero, which is extremely important and very, very often overlooked in these big budget movies. So I appreciated. There was a lot of, you know, you could see there was a lot of art and there was a lot of effort in the movie. And to me, you know, when you can see the effort on the screen, that can always make up for, you know, kind of those little kind of nitpicky things that you can always do to a movie like this. But I mean, if you can tell that the filmmakers and the people making the movie are trying and that they're aspiring to reach a level, you know, to me that gives people a lot of wiggle room for me. You know, do I wish some of the dialogue in the movie was a little stronger? Sure, I do. Right. But visually, I thought they did a fantastic job, and I wish that a domestic audience would more happily embrace it. But you know, it's just one of those things. It's like comics, man. You know, people say that they hate crossovers, but those are the books they buy. So, obviously, they do like crossovers. Obviously, people do like superhero movies, even though if you go on the internet, everybody's sick to death of superhero movies. Like, why are they doing another Spider-Man? Why did they... And before, I'm going to go off on a tangent. Briefly,
go for it.
About people complaining about the new Spider-Man movie and like, why did they revamp it so fast? And it's just like, why? It's like, why are people still asking these questions? It's like, see, I mean, it's the dumbest thing in the world. Spider-Man 3 was an abomination,
yes,
according to me, but you know, according to a lot of people. That movie was an absolute turd and basically lit fire to their entire franchise. So when Sony gets ready to do another Spider-Man movie, why in the world would they continue from a trilogy that they just completely fucked up? I mean, what actor is going to want to sign on to be the Spider-Man that spins out of Spider-Man 3 for the next 10 years of his career? Like, it's stupid that people are still asking these questions and don't even understand the economics of it. Like nobody would ever do that. I mean,
Stop right there. See, you just said it. They don't understand the economics of it. If you can repeat that 40,000 times, I think, you're making sense. I didn't mean to cut you off, but you're making sense.
No problem.
Because I've been saying this, and we talked about this briefly in the past when I said that people don't understand how the X-Men movies work. Right. And how, like, really, up until the X-Men movie, 90% of the population had no goddamn clue who the X-Men were.
No.
A lot of people still don't know who the X-Men are.
They still don't know. Like, 7 movies later, they still don't know or care.
Right. Yet these fans want them to make like a literal translation of what's on the comic book page. Right. I'm like, what the hell is wrong with you people?
Right. It's like nobody wants to see that. It's like, I read the book and I don't want to see that. Why would somebody who's never read, why would we want to see the Clone Wars in movie form? Are you crazy? Why? Who would want to see what is the audience for that?
Well, apparently there are Facebook groups filled with people who just want to see that.
Yeah, well, that's why they're Facebook groups and not actually making these movies. Because, I mean, basically, here's the rules. If you take a shit in your franchise, you have to start over. There you go. That's it. It's as simple as that. It's the same thing that happened with Spider-Man that happened with the X-Men. X-Men 3 made a ton of money, but the majority of people hated it. And it was a poor, poor, poor follow-up to X2, which was one of the better comic book movies that we've ever seen. So what did they have to do? I mean, these dudes had to go back in the past. Like, it wasn't enough to reboot the franchise. They had to go back 40 years in time to get people to see another X-Men movie, and now they're trying to work their way back up to that original timeline that they started. Yeah. But the fact that nobody can, you know, can understand this is just, it's just baffling to me. It's the same logic about Warner Brothers trying to jump the line and going straight to Batman and Superman when they have so much unfinished business for Man of Steel that should be taken care of first.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can't argue that one either.
All right. I feel like we should like stop there because I feel like I'm going to get going again and then this thing will be like 2 hours.
Well, you know, we should do a summer movie wrap up after Elysium.
Because definitely.
I don't know what is coming after Elysium.
Pretty much nothing. I'm excited about Gravity, but I don't think that comes out until October.
That's like, oh, you know what? Riddick comes out in September, which is a dead zone for movies. And I don't understand why they're putting Riddick out the first week of September. Because I used to work in a movie theater when I was really young. And I didn't understand this at all. But my boss once told me, and I hated this guy, but the only thing he ever said that actually stuck with me all these years was that if they release a movie in January or September, it usually means it's awful.
Yes.
And I said, well, why is that? And he said, well, one, in January, people have already spent all their money on Christmas, and kids are going back to school, and eligibility is already passed. So it's just a movie they need to release and dump it out there just to get rid of it contractually. Mm. And I said, oh, well, what about September? He's like, well, people are going back to school, and there's a whole lot of money spent on school. College kids the first week of September are not going to the movies.
No.
Generally speaking, people won't have money again to spend on anything until probably the last weeks of October, heading into November. Mm-hmm. And that's when the Oscars start really paying attention. So even though the Riddick franchise has a considerable fan base, they're sending a really bad message by releasing that in September.
Yeah. Yep. Doesn't look promising.
No, but, it doesn't. And it's sad because the Riddick, you know, last time we saw Riddick, he's left off at a really great moment. And I was like, where are they going to build with this? And then I see the trailer. I'm like, well, they went back to Pitch Black. Great.
Right. Didn't they continue the storyline of Riddick in a video game?
No. See, the thing was, there was a video game, Escape from Butcher Bay.
Okay.
But that's also a cross. It's a bridge between Pitch Black and Chronicles of Riddick.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
They have had zero follow-up to the end of Chronicles of Riddick when he takes over the Necromongers.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, so he becomes the Lord of the Necromongers, and you leave at that point. And that was a great cliffhanger ending. And I see, you know, the new movie looks like, oh, well, we didn't want to do with that, so let's just turn it back and Pitch Black.
No. Too complicated.
Yeah, God forbid we make these people think of a great story, you know, but, you know, let's go back to what they like, which is fighting
monsters. Man, that's too complicated.
So, yeah, I think after Elysium, we should just wrap up how hits and misses of summer of 2013.
Oh, my God. You know what? I have a title for it already.
What's that?
Cruel Summer. We'll just leave it at that.
This was a cruel summer, wasn't it? I was so jazzed up for all the stuff that was coming out, and I was just let down repeatedly. And the one movie, well, actually, I was really excited about Pacific Rim, but I haven't seen Wolverine yet. I'm hearing good things about it, but surprisingly, no one went to see it. Nope. It only made $55 million. Now, I'm betting that that's probably a good movie, but people, once again, did not go see it.
I don't know. I mean, people say a change is coming to Hollywood, and the amount and kind of like the volume of these blockbusters. But I wouldn't be surprised in a couple of years if it was just, you know, comic book movies and then a bunch of smaller, smarter, you know, action movies, and that, you know, people are getting bored with, you know, blowing cities up with all of these kind of nameless, faceless, bloodless casualties. And I think people are kind of reaching their tolerance point for it, at least for a little while. Because, I mean, there have been a trail of, you know, of underperforming blockbusters this summer. So, you know, I think Cruel Summer is very appropriate. in discussing a lot of these summer movies. So, you know, I think we'll leave it there. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. Hope you had a great experience at Comic-Con this year. And I just want to say thank you to the people that came up to me personally and had kind words to say about this podcast and about my work. And I deeply, deeply appreciate it. I never expect it for some reason. I don't know. I think that's just me being me. So it's much appreciated. And I hope to see you guys next year at the show. And, go see Pacific Rim if you haven't already.
Absolutely. And I wanted to say, as a wrap up as well, thanks for all the people who came to our panel.
Yes.
We're going to be doing it again at Stan Lee's Kamikaze if you're in Southern California in L.A. We'll probably do it at the Long Beach Comic-Con later this fall. And I will be at New York Comic-Con. Are you going to New York Comic-Con?
I'm crossing my fingers on it. I'm not sure yet.
Okay, because what I'm going to say is if you can go, and if I get this panel approved, then I would like to have you on that panel in New York.
Okay. Yeah, so there's actually going to be a couple of cool black sci-fi panels that are in the works for New York Comic Con. So that'll be something for everybody to keep an eye on.
Absolutely. And, you know, as Brandon said, this has been a great experience, and I'm glad you guys are listening. And please keep on, and please let people know about it. Don't keep it to yourself.
That's another thing. Don't keep it a secret. Because if you keep it a secret, it'll stay a secret.
And that's the problem.
All right. Well, we'll see you guys next time. Thank you again for listening. Peace.
Peace.